Chapter 34 Yao. "Where are you now, Francis?" asked Yao. He sat on the floor next to her stretcher and removed her headphones so she could hear him.
"I'm in a story, Yao," said Francis.
He couldn't see her eyes because of the mask, but her face was animated.
"I'm writing the story, and I'm in the story. It's quite a nice story. I've got a kind of magic realism vibe going, which is new for me. I like it. Nothing needs to make sense."
"Okay," said Yao. "Who else is in the story with you?"
"My friend, Jillian. She died in her sleep when she was 49. It's called sudden adult death syndrome. I thought it was just for babies. I didn't even know it was possible."
"Does Jillian have anything to say to you?"
"Not really. I told her about the review."
"Francis, forget the review." It wasn't professional, but Yao couldn't hide his frustration. Francis kept talking on and on about the review. Shouldn't authors be used to bad reviews? Wasn't it just an occupational hazard? "Try being a paramedic. See how you go when a psycho husband holds a knife to your throat while you're trying to save his wife's life, which you can't save because she's already dead. Try that, Francis." Francis pushed up her mask and looked at Yao. Her hair stuck up comically, as if she'd just got out of bed.
"I'll have the seafood linguine, thank you so much."
She snapped an imaginary menu shut, pulled her mask back over her eyes, and began to hum Amazing Grace. Yao checked her pulse and thought of a long ago night after a university party when he'd looked after a drunk girl in someone's bedroom. Yao listened to her incoherent, slurred rambling for hours and made sure she didn't choke on her vomit before he finally fell asleep and woke up at dawn to her face inches away from his and her sick, sweet breath in his nostrils.
"Get out," she said.
"I never touched you," Yao told her. "Nothing happened."
"Get the fuck out," she said.
He felt like he had taken advantage of her, raped an unconscious girl. It didn't matter that he would never do such a thing, that he wanted to make a career out of healing. At that moment, he was the representative for his gender, and he had to cop it on the chin for all their sins. Guiding Francis on her psychedelic therapeutic journey was nothing like looking after a drunk girl. And yet, it kind of felt like looking after a drunk girl.
"I haven't had sex in so long," said Francis. White spittle gathered at the corner of her mouth.
Yao felt a little ill. "That's too bad," he said. He looked over at Marcia, who sat with Ben and Jessica, their three shadows enormous on the wall. Marcia nodded as the couple spoke. It seemed like their therapy was going well. Delilah was talking to Lars, who had sat up from his stretcher and was chatting calmly with her, as if they were both guests at a party. All his patients were fine. He had a crash cart on standby. They were all being monitored. There was nothing to worry about, and yet it was so strange, because right now, all his senses were screaming one inexplicable word.
Run. Chapter 35. Tony. Tony ran across an endless field of emerald green, carrying an oddly shaped football that weighed as much as 3 bricks. His arms ached. Footballs weren't normally that heavy. Banjo ran along beside him. He was a puppy again, bounding along with the same joyful abandon as a toddler, getting in between Tony's legs, tail wagging. Tony understood that if he wanted to be happy again, he simply needed to kick this strange, misshapen football through the goal. The football represented everything he hated about himself, all his mistakes, his regrets, and his shame. "Sit," he said to Banjo. Banjo sat. His big brown eyes looked up at Tony trustingly. "Stay," he said. Banjo stayed. His tail whooshed back and forth across the grass. Tony saw the white goalposts rise like skyscrapers above him. He lifted his foot, made contact. The ball sailed in a perfect arc across a clear blue sky. He knew immediately it was good. That roller coaster feeling in his stomach. There was nothing better. Better than sex. It had been so long. The crowd roared as the ball went straight through the middle of the goalposts, and the euphoria blasted like rocket fuel through his body as he leaped high in the sky, one fist raised like a superhero. Chapter 36. Carmel. Carmel sat on a plush velvet couch in a snooty fashion shop specializing in the latest designer bodies. Carmel wasn't wearing a body. It was so wonderful and relaxing not wearing a body. No thighs, no stomach, no bum, no biceps, no triceps, no cellulite, no crow's feet, no frown marks, no caesarean scar, no sun damage, no fine lines, no 7 signs of aging, no dry hair, no frizzy hair, no grey hair, nothing to wax or colour or condition, nothing to lengthen or flatten, conceal or disguise. She was just Carmel, without her body. Show me your original face. The one you had before your parents were born. Her little girls sat either side of her on the couch, waiting for her to choose a new body. They were all quietly reading age-appropriate quality chapter books and eating freshly cut fruit. No devices, no sugary snacks, no arguing. Carmel was the best mother in the history of mothering. Let's find you a divine new body for your divine new life, said Marcia, who was the manager of the shop. She was dressed as a Disney princess. Marcia ran her finger along a rack filled with different bodies on hangers. No, no, maybe, oh, now this one is nice. She draped the body over one arm. This would look lovely on you. It's very fashionable and such a flattering shape. It was Sonia's body, her sleek blonde hair, her trim waist. I don't like the ankles, said Carmel. I prefer a more finely tapered ankle. Also, my husband's new girlfriend has that exact same body. We don't want that one then, said Marcia. She hung it back up and selected another one from the rack.
How about this one? So striking. You'll turn heads wearing this one.
It was Marsha's body. It's amazing, but honestly, I don't think I can carry it off, said Carmel. It's kind of too dramatic for me. Her daughter, Lulu, put down her book. She had peach smeared around her mouth. Carmel went to wipe it away, but then she remembered she had no fingers. Fingers were useful. That's your body there, Mummy, said Lulu, and she pointed at Carmel's body sagging on a door handle, without even a hanger. That's my old body, darling, said Carmel. Mummy needs a new one. It's yours. Lulu was implacable as always. Marsha held up Carmel's old body.
It does look very comfortable, she said.
Could we at least take it in a few inches? Said Carmel.
Of course we can.
Marsha smiled at her.
We'll make it beautiful. Here, try it on.
Carmel sighed and put back on her old body.
It really suits you, said Marsha. Just some minor adjustments.
I quite like the ankles, admitted Carmel. What do you think, girls? Her daughters threw themselves at her. Carmel marveled at the blue veins in her hands as she cupped her daughters' heads, the thump of her heart and the strength of her arms as she hefted a little girl on each hip.
I'll take it, she said. You're going to love your body, said Marsha.
Chapter 37 Marsha.
My God, it is all going incredibly well, thought Marsha. The therapy was working exactly as the research said it would. Carmel Schneider had just made a breakthrough in relation to her body image issues. There had been a moment where for some reason she kept trying to take her clothes off, but Marsha had put a stop to that, and she just had a very good conversation with her about body acceptance. The triumph was as tangible as a trophy, solid and gleaming gold in Marsha's hands.
Chapter 38 Napoleon. Napoleon sat with his back against a wall of the studio, watching the floor breathe in and out with the rapid, heartbreaking vulnerability of a sleeping baby. This happened last time, he reminded himself. It was just an optical illusion. Walls and floors did not breathe. And so what if they did breathe? What was so bad about that? The walls of that seedy, smoky club had breathed, too, and he'd become convinced he was trapped within an amoeba hurtling through space. It had made perfect sense at the time. The amoeba had swallowed him whole, like the whale swallowed Jonah, and he was stuck in that amoeba for 1,000 years. 20 years old, and he was so sure his brain had been fried, and he took such pride in his brain, and the only way to comfort himself in the bleak days that followed was by chanting, "Never again, never again, never again." And yet, here he was, trapped once more. "I'm not in an amoeba," he told himself. "I'm at a health resort. They have given me drugs without my permission, and I'm just going to have to wait this out."
At least he was in this very pleasant, nice-smelling, candle-lit studio. Not that packed bar with all those looming faces. He held hands with his girls. Heather's hand in his left, Zoe's in his right. Napoleon had refused to lie down on one of those stretchers or put on the mask and headphones. He knew the only way to keep a good, firm grip of his mind was to sit upright, with his eyes open. Marcia pretended she was fine with that, but Napoleon knew she was annoyed that they weren't following the correct procedure for optimum results. Napoleon recognized the moment she made the decision not to push the issue. It was like he could read her mind. "Pick your battles," she thought. Napoleon had to pick his battles with his students. He was good at picking his battles. He used to do the same with the kids. "Pick your battles," he said softly. "Pick them carefully. I know which battle I'm picking. I will not rest until that woman is behind bars," said Heather. She was watching Marcia move about the room, chatting to her guests, placing the back of her hand against their foreheads. "Look at her, sashaying about as if she's fucking Florence Nightingale," said Heather. "Psychedelic therapy, my foot." Napoleon wondered if there was some sort of professional jealousy going on here. "Can you see the walls breathing?" he asked, to take her mind off things. "It's just the effects of the drugs," said Heather. "Well, I know that, darling," said Napoleon. "I just wondered if you were experiencing the same effects." "I can see the walls breathing, Dad," said Zoe. "They look like fish. It's awesome. Are you seeing the colours?" She glided her hands back and forth, as if through water. "I am," marveled Napoleon. "It's like phosphorescence." "Great. A nice druggy dad and daughter bonding experience," said Heather. Napoleon noted that she was in a very bad mood. "Zach would think this was hilarious," said Zoe. "All of us getting high together." "He's here, actually," said Napoleon. "Hi, Zach." "Hey, Dad." It didn't even seem that remarkable that Zach was sitting right in front of him, wearing shorts and no shirt. The kid never wore a shirt. It just felt like everything was right again, the way it used to feel. The four of them hanging out together, taking each other's existences for granted. Just being a family, a run-of-the-mill family. "Do you see him?" said Napoleon. "Yes," said Zoe.
"I see him too,"
said Heather, her voice full of tears. "Your turn to take out the recycling, Zach," said Zoe. Zach gave his sister the finger, and Napoleon laughed out loud. Chapter 39. Frances. Frances sat up on her stretcher, pushed back her headphones, and pulled her eye mask down around her neck. "Thank you," she said to Delilah, who sat next to her, smiling at her in a way that could be called condescending, as a matter of fact. "That was lovely. Quite an experience. I feel like I learned a great deal. How much do I owe you?" "I don't think you're done yet," said Delilah. Francis looked around the room. Lars and Tony were on stretchers next to each other. Tony's head lolled to one side, his feet splayed in a V-shape. Meanwhile, Lars's profile looked like that of a Grecian god, and his feet were neatly crossed at the ankles, as if he were napping on a train while listening to a podcast. Ben and Jessica were in a corner of the room kissing like young lovers who have just discovered kissing and have all the time in the world. Their hands moved over each other's bodies with slow, passionate reverence. "Goodness," said Frances, "that looks like fun." She continued to survey the room. Carmel lay on her stretcher, her thick black hair spread like seaweed around her head. She held up her hands and wriggled her fingers as if she were trying to see them through her eye mask. Napoleon, Heather, and Zoe sat in a row with their backs against the wall, like young travellers stranded at an airport. There was a boy sitting in front of them. He stuck his finger up at Zoe. "Who is that boy?" said Francis. "The boy without the shirt." "There is no boy," said Delilah. She reached for Francis's headphones. "He's laughing," said Francis. She tried and failed to grab at Delilah's arm to stop her pulling the eye mask back over her eyes. "I think I'll go say hello." "Stay with me, Francis," said Delilah. Chapter 40. Heather. Heather focused on her breathing. She was determined to keep a tiny part of her brain safe and sober and in charge of monitoring the effects of the psilocybin and LSD. One brightly lit office window in a dark office tower. She knew, for example, that in reality her son rotted beneath the earth. He was not really there with them. And yet he seemed so real. And when she reached out to touch his arm, it was his flesh, firm and smooth and tanned. He tanned easily, and he was hopeless about putting on sunscreen, even though she nagged. "Don't go, Zach!" Napoleon jerked upright and reached out his hands. "He's not going, Dad," said Zoe. She pointed. "He's still right there." "My boy," sobbed Napoleon. His body convulsed. "He's gone." His sobs were guttural, uncontrolled. "My boy, my boy, my boy." "Stop that," said Heather. "This was not the place, not the time." "It was the drugs." Not everyone reacted the same way to drugs. Some laboring mothers got plastered on just one whiff of nitrous oxide. Others screamed at Heather that it wasn't working. Napoleon had always been susceptible. He couldn't even cope with coffee. One long black, and you'd think he'd taken speed. An over-the-counter painkiller could send him loopy. The only time he ever had a general anaesthetic, which was for a knee reconstruction the year before Zach died, he'd had a bad reaction when he came out of it and scared a poor young nurse to death by supposedly speaking in tongues about the Garden of Eden, although it wasn't clear how she understood what he was saying if he was speaking in tongues. "She must be fluent in tongues," Zach had said. And Zoe had laughed so much. And there was no greater pleasure in Heather's life than watching her children make each other laugh. "Watch your husband," she thought.
monitor him. She narrowed her eyes and clenched her jaw to maintain focus. But she felt herself drift, hopelessly, inevitably away on a sea of memories. She is walking down the street, pushing her two babies in a big double stroller, and every single old lady stops to make a comment, and Heather is never going to make it to the shops. She's a little girl, staring at her mother's stomach, wishing she could make a baby grow in there so that she can have a brother or sister. But the wishing doesn't work. Wishing never works. And when she grows up, she will never have an only child, a lonely only. She is opening the door of her son's bedroom because she's going to do a load of washing and she may as well scrape up some of the layer of clothes on his floor, and her whole body resists what she is seeing, and she thinks, I'm doing a load of washing. Don't do this, Zach. I want to do laundry. I want to keep this life. Please, please let me keep this life. But she hears herself screaming because she knows it's too late. There is nothing to be done. The life of 1 second ago is gone. She is at her son's funeral, and her daughter is delivering a eulogy. And afterwards, people keep touching Heather, so much touching. Everyone wants to pour at her. It is repulsive. And they're all saying, oh, you must be so proud. Zoe spoke so beautifully, as if it's fucking school speech night. Not her son's funeral. And can't you see my daughter is alone now? How can she live without her brother? She never even existed without him. And who cares if she spoke beautifully? She can't even stand. Her father is holding her upright. My daughter can't even walk. She is watching Zoe take her first steps at only 11 months. And Zach, who has never even considered such a thing, is shocked. He can hardly believe it. He is sitting on the carpet with his little plump legs stuck out in front of him, and he is looking up at his sister with big astonished eyes, and you can see he's thinking, what is she doing? And she and Napoleon are laughing so hard. And maybe wishes do come true, because this is family. This is what she never had, never knew, never dreamed. This is a moment so perfect and funny, and this is her life now. Just a string of perfect, funny moments, one after the other, like a string of beads that will go on forever. Except that it won't. She is alone in Zach's bedroom crying, and she thinks that Napoleon and Zoe are somewhere in the house crying too, all alone, crying in separate rooms. And she thinks families are probably meant to grieve together, but they aren't doing it right. And to distract herself, she goes through Zach's drawers for the 100th time. Even though she knows there is nothing to find, no note, no explanation, she knows exactly what she will find, except that this time she does find something. She was back. Napoleon still rocked and sobbed. Had she been gone for a second, or an hour, or a year? She didn't know. How are the Marconi family feeling right now? Masha sat in front of them. Could this perhaps be a good opportunity for a family therapy session about your loss? Masha had multiple arms and multiple legs, but Heather refused to acknowledge her multiple limbs because it was not real. People simply did not have that many limbs. Heather had never once delivered a baby with that many limbs. She was not falling for it. When you say it's your fault, Napoleon, are you referring to Zach? Asked Marcia, all faux concern. Heather heard herself hiss, Jesus fucking Christ. Heather was a snake with a long forked tongue that could whip from her mouth and pierce Marcia's skin, shooting venom through her veins, poisoning her. The same way Marcia had poisoned Heather's family. Don't you dare talk about our son. You know nothing about our son.
My fault. My fault. My fault.
Napoleon banged his head against the wall. He was in danger of concussing himself. Heather gathered up all her mental strength to focus her mind and crawled around to face Napoleon on her hands and knees. She grabbed his head between her hands. She could feel his ears against her palms, the warmth of his stubbled skin. Listen to me, she said in the loud, carrying voice she used to cut through the screams of a woman in labor. Napoleon's eyes rolled about, bulging and veined with blood like a frightened horse.
I pressed snooze on my alarm, he said.
He repeated it over and over.
I pressed snooze on my alarm. I pressed snooze on my alarm.
I know you did, said Heather. You've told me so many times, darling, but it wouldn't have made a difference.
It wasn't your fault, Dad, said Zoe, her lonely only.
And it seemed to Heather that she spoke very much like a zombie, not a university student, and that her young, beautiful mind was already fried like an egg, sizzled to a crisp.
It was my fault.
Good, said Marcia, the poisoner. This is so good. You are all speaking from your hearts. Heather turned and screamed in her face. Fuck off! A pellet of Heather's spittle flew in a slow arc from her mouth and hit the target of Marcia's eye. Marcia smiled. She wiped her eye. Excellent. Release all that rage, Heather. Let it all out. She stood, and her multiple limbs drifted about her like an octopus's tentacles. I will be back momentarily. Heather turned back to her family. Listen, she said. Listen to me. Napoleon and Zoe made eye contact with her. They were all three in a temporary air pocket of clarity. It wouldn't last. Heather had to speak fast. She opened her mouth and began to tug an endless tapeworm from deep down in her throat, and it was making her gag and vomit, but there was relief in it too. Because at last she was wrenching it free from her body. Chapter 41. Zoe. The walls no longer breathed. The colours were fading. Zoe felt like she was sobering up. It was like that feeling at the end of a party when you walked out of a stuffy room into the night air and your mind cleared. Zach was on medication, said Zoe's mother, for his asthma. Why did that matter? Zoe could tell that her mother thought she was sharing something momentous here, but she had learned that what was momentous to your parents was often not that momentous to you, and what was momentous to you was often not that momentous to your parents. I like to call it Zachariah's theory of momenticity, said Zach, who was still there with them. Don't tell me your theories. I'm all alone, taking care of the parents, said Zoe. And it's an onerous responsibility, thou fuckwit, because they are both cray-cray. I know. I'm sorry, thou mangled, pox-marked clack-dish, said Zach. I need you to concentrate, Zoe, said her mother. I know he was on medication for his asthma, said her dad. A preventative. So what? One of the side effects can be depression and suicidal thoughts, said Heather. I told you the specialist wanted to prescribe it to him, and you said, are there any side effects? And I said, no. The regret dragged at her face like claw marks. You said no, repeated Zoe's father. I said no, said her mother. Her eyes were pleading for forgiveness. I'm so sorry. A cliff face of momentosity loomed in front of Zoe. I hadn't even read the leaflet in the box, said her mother. I knew Dr. Chang was the best. I knew he wouldn't prescribe anything with dangerous side effects. I trusted him, so I just said, no, it's all fine. I've checked. But I lied to you, Napoleon. I lied. Zoe's dad blinked. After a while, he said slowly, I would have trusted him too. You would have read the leaflet. You would have gone through it so carefully, reading every word, asking me questions, driving me crazy. I'm the one with the medical training, but I didn't even read it. I thought I was so busy at that time. I didn't know what I thought I was so busy doing. Her mother rubbed her hands down her cheeks as if she were trying to smear herself away. I read the leaflet about 6 months after he died. I found it in his bedroom drawer. Well, darling, it wouldn't have made any difference, said her dad dully. We needed to get the asthma under control. But if we'd known depression was a possibility, we would have monitored him, said Zoe's mother. She looked desperate to make him understand the full breadth of her guilt. You would have, Napoleon. I know you would have. There were no signs, said her dad. Sometimes there are no signs, no signs at all. He was perfectly happy. There were signs, said Zoe. Her parents turned to her, and their faces were like those clown faces at an amusement park, turning back and forth, mouths agape, waiting for the ball to drop. I knew he was upset about something. She remembered walking by his bedroom and registering the fact that Zach was lying on his bed, but he wasn't looking at his phone or listening to music or reading. He was just lying there. And that was not Zach. Zach didn't just lie on his bed and stare at the ceiling. I thought something was going on at school, she told her parents. But I was angry with him. We weren't talking. I didn't want to be the first one to talk. Zoe closed her eyes so she could not see the disappointment and pain on her parents' faces.
She whispered, "It was a competition to see who would be the first one to talk." "Oh, Zoe, sweetheart," said her mother from far, far away. "It's not your fault. You know it's not your fault." "I was going to talk on our birthday," said Zoe. "I was going to say, 'Happy birthday, loser.'" "Oh, Zoe, you stupid head," said Zach. He put his arm around her. They never hugged. They weren't that sort of brother and sister. Sometimes when they passed each other in the hallway, they randomly shoved each other for no reason at all, like hard enough to hurt. But now he was hugging her and talking in her ear. And it was him. It was Zach. It was absolutely him. He smelled of that stupid Lynx body wash, which he said he used ironically, but he totally used because he believed the ads about how it made the girls think you were hotter. Zach pulled her close and whispered in her ear, "It was nothing to do with you. I didn't do it to get at you." He gripped her arm to make sure she got his point. "I wasn't me." Chapter 42. Napoleon. He would do anything for his girls. Anything. So he took the dreadful, heavy secrets they'd been carrying, and he saw the relief with which they handed them over. And now he had his own secret, because he would never tell them how angry their secrets made him. Never, ever. Never, ever, ever. The walls continued to pulsate as his wife and daughter held his hands, and he knew this nightmare would last an eternity. Chapter 43. Marcia. Ben and Jessica sat cross-legged on cushions, facing each other. Their hands gripped each other's forearms, as if they were on a narrow beam and trying to maintain their balance. It was glorious to see. Ben spoke directly from his heart, and Jessica listened, transfixed by his every word. Marcia guided only when necessary. The MDMA was doing exactly what it was meant to do, dissolving barriers. They could have spent months in therapy to get to this point. This was an instant shortcut. "I miss your face," Ben said to Jessica. "Your beautiful face. I don't recognize you. I don't recognize us or anything about our lives. I miss our old flat. I miss my job. I miss the friends we lost because of this. But most of all, I miss your face." His words were crisp and clear. There was no slurring, no equivocation. "Good," said Marcia. "Wonderful. Jessica, what do you want to say?"
"I think that Ben is body shaming," said Jessica. "I'm still me. I'm still Jessica. I'm still in here. So what if I look a bit different? This is the fashion. It's just fashion. It's not important."
"It's important to me," said Ben. "It feels like you took something precious and fucked it up."
"But I feel beautiful," said Jessica. "I feel like I was ugly before and now I'm beautiful." She stretched her arms above her head like a ballerina. The question is, who gets to decide if I'm beautiful or not? Me? You? The internet?
Right now, she did look beautiful.
Ben considered for a moment.
It's your face, he said. So I guess you should decide.
But wait, beauty is...
Jessica pointed at her eye. She began to laugh.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
She and Ben laughed and laughed. They clutched each other, repeating, "Beauty is in the eye of the beholder," over and over, and Masha smiled at them uncertainly. Why was that funny? Perhaps it was an inside joke. She began to feel impatient. At long last, they stopped laughing, and Jessica sat up and touched her lower lip.
Look, fair call. I might have overdone it on the lips last time.
I liked your lips before, said Ben. I thought you had beautiful lips.
Yeah, I get it, Ben, said Jessica.
I liked our life before, said Ben.
It was a shitty little life, said Jessica. An ordinary, shitty little life.
I don't think it was shitty, said Ben.
I feel like you love your car more than me, said Jessica. I'm jealous of your car. I was the one who scratched it. That was me. Because I feel like your car is a slutty girl having an affair with my husband, and so I scratched her slutty face.
Wow, said Ben. He put both hands to the top of his head.
Wow, that is... Wow. I can't believe you did that.
He didn't sound angry, just amazed.
I love the money, said Jessica. I love being rich. But I wish we could just be rich and still be us.
The money, said Ben slowly, is like a dog.
Said Jessica. A great big out of control pet dog.
Yeah, said Jessica.
Yeah. That's right.
She paused.
Why is it like a dog?
So, it's like we got a dog, and it's the dog we always wanted. We dreamed of this dog. This dog is our dream dog. But it's changed everything about our lives. It's like really distracting. It barks all through the night, wanting our attention. It won't let us sleep. We can't do anything without taking the dog into account. We have to walk it and feed it and worry about it. And
he scrunched up his face, working it out.
See, the problem with this dog is that it bites. It bites us, and it bites our friends and family. It's got a really vicious streak, this dog.
But we still love it, said Jessica.
We love the dog.
We do, but I think we should give the dog away, said Ben. I think it's not the right dog for us. We could get a labradoodle, said Jessica. Labradoodles are so cute.
Masha reminded herself that Jessica was very young.
I think Ben is using the dog as a story to explain how the lottery win has impacted your lives, she said. A metaphor, that is.
The word metaphor came to her a fraction later than she would have liked.
Yeah, said Jessica. She gave Masha a sly, shrewd look and tapped her nose with her forefinger. If we're gonna get a dog, we should get it before the baby comes.
What baby? Said Masha.
What baby? Said Ben. I'm pregnant, said Jessica. You are? Said Ben. But that's awesome.
Masha reeled. But you never.
You gave my pregnant wife drugs, said Ben to Masha.
Yeah, I kind of feel really angry about that, said Jessica to Masha. Like, I think you should go to jail for a very long time for this.
Chapter 44. Heather woke, but did not open her eyes. She was lying on her side, on something thin and soft, her hands pillowed beneath her head. Her body clock told her it was morning. Maybe around 7 a.m., she would have guessed. She was no longer high. Her mind felt clear. She was in the yoga and meditation studio at Tranquillum House, and today was the anniversary of Zach's death. After years of nausea, she'd vomited up her secret, and now she felt shaky, strange, and empty. But also better. She felt cleansed, which, funnily enough, was exactly what Tranquillum House had promised. Heather would have to write them a glowing testimonial. I feel so much better after my time at Tranquillum House. I especially enjoyed tripping with my husband and daughter. Obviously, they would leave this place immediately. They would not eat or drink anything provided by Masha. They would go straight to their rooms, pack, get in the car, and leave. Perhaps they would go to a cafe in the nearest town and order a big fried breakfast in Zach's honor. Heather wanted to spend this year's anniversary alone with her family talking about Zach. And tomorrow, she wanted to somehow mark her children's 21st birthday in a way that wasn't about shame or grief, or everyone pretending to forget that this was Zoe's birthday too. Napoleon had been saying it for so long. We have to separate Zach from the way he chose to end his life. There was so much more to Zach than his suicide. One memory should not eclipse all the other memories. But she hadn't listened. She had somehow thought that his unhappiness that one day nullified everything else that he did in his life. Now, all at once, she knew that Napoleon was right. Today they would mark the anniversary of his death by pooling their best memories of his 18 years of life. And the grief would be unbearable. But Heather knew better than anyone that the unbearable could be borne. For the last 3 years, she'd been grieving Zach's suicide. Now it was finally time to grieve his loss. The loss
of a beautiful, silly, smart, impetuous boy. She hoped that his sister would cope today. All that rubbish about not being close to Zach. Heather's heart ached for her. The child adored her brother. They were 10 years old before they stopped creeping into each other's beds at night when they had nightmares. Heather would need to tell her over and over that it wasn't her fault. It was Heather's failure alone. Her failure to notice her son's change in behavior and her failure to give anyone, including Zach himself, a reason to look for it. And at some point today, they would report the mad woman's actions to the police. Heather opened her eyes and saw that she was lying on a yoga mat, face to face with her sleeping daughter. She was still asleep, her eyelids fluttering. Heather was close enough to feel Zoe's breath on her face. She put her hand to her cheek. Chapter 45. Frances. Frances pulled the headphones from her head. They got caught in her hair. She tugged them free, her eyes still shut. She was on a flight. The only time she fell asleep wearing headphones was on a flight. She could hear the sound of far-off construction. A drill. A jackhammer. A digger. Some such thing. It was an intermittent mechanical roar. A lawnmower? A leaf blower? She lay on her side, drew the blanket up over her shoulders, and tried to make herself sink back into deep, delicious sleep. But no, there was the sound again, pulling her inexorably up, up, up. And it wasn't a machine. It was the sound of a man snoring. Had she got drunk and slept with a stranger last night? Good Lord, surely not. It had been decades. She didn't feel any of the symptoms of a hangover or the shame of a seedy sexual encounter. Her mind felt clear and bright, as if it had been pressure cleaned. Her memory clicked into place in one solid block. She was in the yoga and meditation studio at Tranquillum House, and yesterday she'd drunk a delicious smoothie containing hallucinogenic drugs, resulting in an extremely beautiful, remarkably vivid dream that had lasted forever. About Jillian and her dad and her ex-husbands, with many symbols and visual metaphors which she looked forward to interpreting. Yao and sometimes Delilah and sometimes Marcia had kept interrupting her lovely dream, asking irritating questions and trying to steer her in certain directions. Frances had ignored them. She was having too much fun, and they were aggravating her. She sensed that after a while, they gave up on her. She'd been in space. She'd been an ant, also a butterfly. She'd been on a sleigh ride with Jillian across a stunning starlit sky. And more, much more. It was like waking up the first morning back home in your own bed after a long international holiday to multiple exotic locations. She opened her eyes to darkness and remembered her eye mask. The sound of snoring got even louder as she pulled it off. Her eyes didn't feel gritty or blurry. Everything was in crisp color. She could see the vaulted stone ceiling above her. Rows of downlights. They were all switched on. She sat up and looked around. The man snoring was Lars. He lay on the stretcher next to hers, flat on his back, still wearing his eye mask. A blanket pulled up to his chin, his mouth wide open. His body twitched in tandem with each snore. It was pleasing to hear someone so good-looking with such a loud, unpleasant snore. It kind of redressed the balance. Francis reached over with her bare foot and gave his leg a gentle shove. Henry was a snorer. Once, towards the end of the marriage, he was wearing shorts, and he'd looked down and said confusedly, "I don't know why I'm always getting these bruises right here on my calf. It's like I keep bumping into something." "My right foot," thought Frances. She felt terrible about that, right up until their last day together, when they fought over the division of cutlery. She scanned the room. Tony, she would not be calling him Smiley, had just sat up on his stretcher. It looked like he had a headache by the way he rested his forehead in his hands. Carmel was also upright and was attempting to comb her fingers through her black frizzy hair, which stood out in a wild halo around her head. She met Francis's eye. "Bathroom?" she mouthed, although she'd been in the studio as often as Francis. Francis pointed to the toilets at the back of the cellar, and Carmel got to her feet, staggering a little. Ben and Jessica sat shoulder to shoulder against a wall, drinking bottled water. Heather and Zoe lay face to face where they had fallen asleep on a yoga mat. Heather was absently caressing Zoe's hair. "Need water?" Napoleon crouched down with difficulty on his long legs in front of Frances and offered her a bottle of water. "I'm assuming it's not spiked with drugs," he said. "I guess if we're worried, we could just drink from the tap. Although they could do something to the water supply if they really wanted." "Thank you." Frances accepted the water, suddenly desperate for it, and drank nearly the whole bottle in one go. "Just what I needed," she said. "I guess it's a good sign that they left us with water," said Napoleon. He straightened. "They haven't completely abandoned us." "What do you mean?" asked Frances. She stretched luxuriously. She was really looking forward to breakfast. "We're locked in," said Napoleon apologetically, as if he were the one responsible. "There doesn't seem to be a way out." Chapter 46. Carmel. "I'm sure this is all just part of the process," said Carmel. She didn't know why everyone looked so worried. "They're not going to leave us down here for much longer. It's all fine." The time, according to Napoleon, the only one among them with a watch, was coming up to 2 p.m., and they had still not heard from any of the staff at Tranquillum House. They had been down here for close to 24 hours now. They all sat in a circle, similar to the one from the previous day when they'd introduced themselves. Everyone looked exhausted and grimy. The men needed shaves. Carmel was desperate to clean her teeth, but she wasn't especially hungry, even though she hadn't eaten for coming up to 48 hours. So that was kind of wonderful. If appetite suppression was one of the side effects of last night's perfectly enjoyable drug experience, then she was all for it. Each of them had confirmed for themselves that the only access point to the room was the heavy oak door at the bottom of the stairs, and that the door was undeniably, irrefutably locked, with what looked to be a brand new gold security keypad next to the door handle. Presumably there was a code that would unlock the door, but multiple combinations of numbers had been attempted with no success. Francis had suggested that the code might be the same as the one given at the front gate of Tranquillum House. Napoleon said he'd already thought of that, but had no memory of the number. Carmel had no memory of it either. She'd been crying when she arrived at Tranquillum House, suddenly struck by a memory from her honeymoon when they'd stayed at a hotel with a similar-looking intercom. It seemed stupid now. Her honeymoon hadn't been that great. She'd got a terrible UTI. Ben thought he remembered the access code for the front gate, but if he did, the number didn't work. Tony thought he remembered too, although he remembered one digit differently to Ben. But that number didn't work either. Carmel suggested the phone number for Tranquillum House, which for some reason she was able to recite, but they had no luck with that. Francis wondered if the code was related to the letters of the alphabet. They tried various words. Tranquillum. Cleanse. Marsha. Nothing worked. Zoe wondered if it was meant to be a kind of a game, an escape room. She told them there was a bizarre craze where people allowed themselves to be locked up in a room for the pleasure of trying to work out how to escape. Zoe had been to one before. She said it was great fun, with multiple clues concealed in what looked like normal objects. For example, Zoe and her friends had to find and assemble the parts of a torch that had been hidden around the room. The torch could then be used to shine a light on a secret message in the back of a wardrobe with further instructions. A timer counted down the minutes on a wall, and Zoe said they got out just seconds before the timer went off. But if this was an escape room game, it seemed it was a very tricky one. The yoga studio was virtually empty. There were towels, yoga mats, stretcher beds, water bottles, headphones, eye masks, and burnt-out candles from the night before, and that was it. There were no bookshelves with messages in books, no pictures on the wall. There was nothing that could feasibly represent a clue. There were no windows that could be smashed in either the men's or the women's toilets. No manholes, no air conditioning ducts. "It's like we're trapped in a dungeon," said Francis, which Carmel thought was melodramatic, but then the woman wrote romantic fiction for a living, so you had to allow for an overactive imagination. Eventually, they'd sat back down, dispirited and dishevelled. "Yes, this is all just part of the process," said Heather to Carmel. "Spiking our drinks with illegal drugs, locking us up and so on and so forth. Nothing to worry about. It's all fine." She was using a very sarcastic, familiar tone for someone Carmel had only just met. "I'm just saying we should trust the process." Carmel tried to remain reasonable. "You're as deluded as her," said Heather. So that was definitely rude. Carmel reminded herself that Heather had lost her son. She spoke evenly. "I know we're all tired and stressed, but there's no need to get personal."
"This is personal," shouted Heather.
"Sweetheart," said Napoleon. "Don't." The gentle way he scolded his wife made Carmel's heart ache.
"Do you have children, Carmel?" asked Heather in a more civilized tone. I have four little girls, said Carmel carefully.
Well, how would you feel if someone gave your children drugs?
It was true that she wouldn't want a single drug to cross their precious lips.
My children are very little. Obviously, Marcia would never. Do you have any idea of the serious long-term health consequences we could all be facing?
Interrupted Heather.
I feel worse than I've ever felt in my entire life, said Jessica. There you go, said Heather with satisfaction.
Well, I feel better than I've ever felt in my entire life, said Carmel. It wasn't entirely true. There was the teeth situation, but she did feel quite good. Her mind was filled with images she hadn't yet had a chance to interpret, as if she'd just spent a day at some incredible immersive art exhibit.
I feel pretty good so far, admitted Frances. I do have a significant headache, said Lars. Yeah, me too, said Tony.
I feel like I might be down a dress size. Carmel pulled at the loose waistband of her leggings. She frowned, trying to remember some important revelation she'd come to last night about her body. It didn't matter. It did matter. It was the only one she had. Somehow it didn't seem quite so profound and transcendent a revelation when she tried to pin it down with ordinary words. Although I'm not trying to change my body completely, I'm just here to get healthy.
Healthy! Heather banged her palm against her forehead. This place has gone way beyond bloody dieting.
Mum. Zoe put her hand on her mother's knee. Nobody died. We're all still here. Just please relax.
Relax!
Heather took Zoe's hand in hers and shook it.
You could have died. Any one of us could have died. If there was anyone with underlying mental health issues that could have been exacerbated or heart issues. Your dad has high blood pressure. He should never have been given drugs.
People probably think you're the one with mental health issues, murmured Zoe.
That's not helping, said Napoleon.
Can't we just pick the lock on the door? Said Frances, and she looked hopefully at Tony.
Why are you looking at me? Do I look like I have a lot of break and enter experience? He said.
Sorry, said Frances. Carmel could see her point. Tony did look like someone who might have dabbled in a bit of breaking and entering in his youth.
We could try. We need something to pick it with, said Ben. He patted himself down and came up with nothing. I'm sure there's no need to panic just yet, said Napoleon. It's obviously a kind of problem-solving exercise, and eventually she'll realize that we can't solve it.
Lars yawned, then lay down on a yoga mat and shielded his eyes with his arm.
I think they're watching us in here, said Jessica. She pointed to a corner of the ceiling. Isn't that a camera up there?
They all looked up at the tiny security camera with a flashing red light above the blank television screen.
Yao told me they had some kind of security intercom system, said Frances.
Me too, said Carmel, on the first day.
It felt like 100 years ago.
Heather leapt to her feet and addressed the camera. "You let us out immediately," she shrieked. "We did not come here to spend the anniversary of our son's death locked in a room with strangers."
Carmel flinched. She had forgotten the anniversary was today. The woman was allowed to snap and snarl as much as she wanted.
There was silence. Nothing happened. Heather stamped her foot. "I can't believe we're paying for this."
Napoleon stood and pulled Heather into his arms. "It doesn't matter where we are today," he said.
"It does."
Heather cried quietly into his shirt. Suddenly she seemed diminished, all the rage gone, just a tiny, sad, traumatized mother.
"Shh," said Napoleon. She was saying something over and over, and it took a moment for Carmel to distinguish the words.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
"It's okay," said Napoleon. "We're fine. Everything is fine."
Everyone looked away from what seemed like an unbearably private moment. Zoe avoided looking at her parents also. She went to a corner of the room, put one palm against a wall, stood on one leg, and held her ankle in the other hand, doing a yoga class for one. Carmel looked at the blank screen of the television, suddenly desperate to be far, far away from this family's pain, which so dwarfed her own. She felt a sharp stab of homesickness. Her home was beautiful. She recalled this as if it were brand new information. Not a mansion by any means, but a comfortable, sunshine-filled family home, even when it had been trashed by four little girls. She'd been the one to renovate it, to make it beautiful. People said she had an eye. When she got home, she would remember to enjoy it.
"I might see if I can kick that door down," said Tony.
"Great idea," said Carmel. People were always kicking down doors in the movies. It seemed quite simple.
"I'll do it," said Ben. "Or I'll ram it."
Tony limbered up, rolling his shoulders.
"I'll ram it," said Ben.
"The door opens inwards," said Lars. There was a pause.
"Does that matter?"
asked Francis.
"Think about it, Francis," said Lars.
Tony looked deflated.
"Let's try to pick the lock then."
He put his fingertips to his forehead and breathed deeply.
"I'm starting to feel a little claustrophobic. I want to get out of here."
So did Carmel.